Hi, this is the second lecture of the cost effectiveness analysis series course provided by the VE Health Economics Resource Center. We call it HERC. My name is Wei Yu, and the health economist at HERC. And today's instructor is Dr. Risha Giovanni-Maslowski. And Risha is a health economist with HERC and also an investigator with the VE Center for Innovation to Implementation. She is also a consulting assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University. Risha's expertise is in cost-effectiveness analysis, comparative effectiveness research, and quality of care. Her research uses econometric and decision analysis techniques to identify ways to study values specifically to improve the quality and lower the cost of U.S. healthcare. She has expertise in causal inference from observational data, cost effectiveness analysis, meta-analysis, and health-related quality of life measurement. Her content interests include end-of-life care and care for patients with advanced cancer. Risha received her Doctor of Public Health degree from the UCLA School of Public Health. Risha, you can start.
Great. Thank you so much, Wei. And thanks to all of our audience members who have joined us. We appreciate your participation in our cyber seminar series. Today I want to be giving you an overview of decision analysis, and this will really be kind of a broad 30,000-foot lecture to get you situated in the field and help you understand some of the general concepts as they relate to decision analysis. And the follow-up lectures in this series will then build upon this foundation and give you the details needed in order to actually operationalize the type of decision analysis you choose to undertake. So today we're going to be talking about why to use decision analysis and then going into the different types of decision analysis that one can operationalize. One of my other goals today is to help you parse through some of the jargon that is oftentimes used when discussing decision analysis and actually define some of the terms that can be bandied around in potentially erroneous ways. And if you take nothing else away from this lecture, I hope that by the end of it, you will be able to properly distinguish the difference between what is considered cost-effective and what is considered cost-saving. We'll talk more about that in a moment. So let's start off with why to actually use a decision analysis. So generally, you're undertaking a formal decision analysis and not just making a decision off the cuff because you have to choose between funding different types of interventions. And we're all in healthcare and medicine, so usually for us, these are health-related interventions. But they can be any type of intervention. It can be an environmental intervention, an economic intervention, you name it. And the reason that one has to choose between funding different interventions is because there are limited resources and you're not financially able to actually undertake all the interventions that you think have merit. And so you need to figure out which is the best intervention to fund, but oftentimes there's not a clear right answer right off the bat as to which intervention stands out amongst your numerous options as being the one that's most meritorious. And so what we do is engage in a formal decision analysis process where we weigh the pros and cons of each specific intervention in order to make a decision that's informed by evidence. And the characteristics that underpin the decision analysis is that it's logical, it's transparent, and it's quantitative. And these are things that we rely upon so that we're not engaging in opinion-based or emotionally-based discussions or decisions that may be influenced by a saliency bias. When we weigh the pros and cons of a decision, the reason that we do this in a formal quantitative manner is because not all pros and cons are created equal. So one, there may be different consequences of each pro versus each con. So, you know, you may have a pro that sounds great. It may, improve someone's health-related quality of life, and that's fantastic. But the con associated with that decision is that it may kill some people. And so those, of course, are very different in terms of their severity or their consequences. And so we need a way to formally compare the pros and the cons in a quantitative sense. The other component that we need to think about is that the probability of the pro and the probability of the cons may be different. And so you may have the pro of improving someone's health related quality of life may have a high probability, and the con of killing other people may have a small probability, but it's something that we need to formally include into our decision analysis. And of course, whenever we do research, we always have variation, and so we know that there may not just be different probabilities of pros and cons, but there may be variations in the probabilities of these pros and cons that we also need to accommodate into our decision model before we reach an answer that we feel comfortable with. So here's some more specific information about what I mean when I talk about the pros and cons. So let's say you have one intervention, we'll call it option A, and option A has an 80% probability of cure, and it has a 2% probability of serious adverse events. So a high probability of pro, small probability of con, but that con is serious. Option B has a 90% probability of cure, so on first blush it may look a little bit better than option A, but when we look at the con, we see that it also has a higher probability of con. It has a 5% probability of serious adverse events. So the question is, which one do you choose? You have both a higher probability of a good thing happening, but also a higher probability of a bad thing happening. And then we have option C. Option C looks great in terms of probability of cure, has a 98% probability of cure, but it also has a 1% probability of treatment-related death. Now, obviously, this is the most serious con that we have of all of our different options, and even though it has a low probability, it is serious enough that we need to give appropriate weight to the fact that this rare but disastrous event could occur. And then it also has a 1% probability of minor adverse events. So if you were just looking at these on a screen, just as you are right now, it would be a little bit difficult in order to figure out which one is the best option. And that's where we would engage in the formal decision analysis so that we could actually combine all of this information about the pros, the cons, the probability of these pros and cons, the variation in the probability of these pros and cons in order to come to a decision. When we are deciding to choose one intervention, that implicitly means that we are deciding to forego funding different interventions. And that means that there's an opportunity cost. And the reason that we can only choose one option may either be due to funding. Usually organizations have limited budgets, and so that's a very common reason that we have to choose one intervention and incur the opportunity cost of foregoing another intervention. But there may also be resource-based constraints as well. So some examples. If we're talking about directly observed therapy for tuberculosis patients, where you have a nurse go out to a tuberculosis patient's home and watch them take their pills, that is highly resource intensive. If we're also thinking about funding a program that encourages new mothers to breastfeed their children and sending community health coaches, lay people out to the homes of new mothers in order to encourage them to breastfeed, you can see that both these interventions require a lot of manpower. And if you are, let's say, a public health department, you may not have the resources to fund both types of manpower. You may only be able to afford enough manpower for one or the other program. Or, you know, like I said, decision analysis is not just relegated to healthcare. If we were, let's say, looking at environmental regulations, and we were thinking about whether it would be a better decision to fund a cap and trade program versus implementing a carbon tax program on polluters, we would need to think not just about how to fund the rollout of the program, but also how to regulate the program and to ensure that companies were adhering to whichever program we wanted to implement. And so there may be finite amounts of regulatory resources that we could throw at this problem. So these are the reasons why we have to just engage in a decision analysis in order to understand, are we making the decision to fund the program that's going to be the most valuable for the population of interest? So we spoke briefly about variation, and I want to come back to that because this is one of the big reasons why it's more advantageous to engage in a formal quantitative decision analysis process than it is just to kind of evaluate information about different programs. If you're just evaluating information about different programs, it's very hard for you to accommodate mentally what the variation in the probabilities of events, probabilities and pros and cons are. But a formal decision analysis process where you're using a model to do this can accommodate variation. And as all of you are no doubt aware, whenever we're talking about anything in healthcare or medicine, we have a lot of variation. And those variations generally are in kind of what I'd say two buckets. Pardon me. In healthcare, we have real variation, and that may be real variation in the application of an intervention. So if we're talking about a surgical intervention or, let's say, a diabetes management program, there is oftentimes real variation in the skill of the surgeon or real variation in the skill of the nurse that's running the diabetes management program that we would want to accommodate if we were thinking about rolling out a diabetes management program for multiple sites. There could also be variation on the side of the recipient of the intervention. So if you're a patient, patients may have differential adherence to interventions. So some patients are really good about taking their medications all the time. Other patients don't take their medications regularly. Some patients may regularly attend the diabetes management course. Other patients may have off and on attendance. And then there's variation in terms of the response to the intervention. Some patients may do very well in a nurse-led diabetes management program. Other patients may not respond to that type of an intervention. So these are all types of real variation that we would want to accommodate in our decision analysis if we were deciding whether we wanted to fund a diabetes management program. And then there's also sampling error. So sampling error would be when we have data from a group that's not necessarily representative of the population to whom we want to apply the intervention. And this actually happens a lot in decision analysis because we generally are trying to get our inputs for our decision models from randomized controlled trials. And because randomized controlled trials are randomly assigning patients to one intervention or another, we avoid issues of selection bias or confounding by indication. And therefore, the data, the results from a randomized controlled trial are a much cleaner comparison of what happens when somebody gets an intervention versus doesn't get an intervention. The challenge with getting data from randomized controlled trials, while they may have good internal validity, is that they oftentimes have poor external validity or poor generalizability. The restriction, the inclusion and exclusion criteria for enrolling someone in a randomized controlled trial is oftentimes quite strict. And so the people that are involved in the trial may not be representative of the population to whom an intervention may apply. And this type of sampling error is a type of measurement error. So we have variation in the form of real variation, we have variation in the form of measurement error or sampling error, and we need to accommodate both types of variation in our decision model. Pardon me, excuse me, I'm battling the tail end of a cold. So in recap, the reasons that we want to use decision analysis is that we are generally faced with limited resources that we need to allocate in a wise manner. And we may have multiple interventions from which we need to choose one or two in order to fund. Each intervention has its own pros and cons, and each intervention is different. It's different with respect potentially to the condition or the population of interest. It's definitely going to be different with respect to the cost, and it oftentimes is different with respect to health outcomes. And so we need to be able to incorporate all of these types of information when we are making our decisions. We also need to accommodate the fact that there's uncertainty around many of our estimates of the pros and the cons of an intervention and our estimates of how much an intervention costs and the health outcomes associated with it. One of the big advantages of decision analysis is that you're able to evaluate each intervention using the same measure. So before we talked about thinking about funding a directly observed therapy program for tuberculosis patients versus funding community health workers that encourage patients to, new mothers to breastfeed their children. So those are obviously very different patient populations. Those are very different conditions. And the benefit of a decision analysis is that we're actually able to evaluate each one of these different conditions and different interventions for these conditions using the same metric. And in that sense, we're able to at least have more of an apples-to-apples comparison or use the same types of measures to evaluate the cost and the benefit of each one of these interventions. And when we do decision analysis and we evaluate very different interventions on different populations or for different conditions using the same metric, those same metrics could be a variety of things. We could look at cost. We could look at cost per life year saved, or we could look at cost per quality adjusted life year. When you are thinking about decision analysis and to which types of problems you can apply it, the answer is really pretty much anything that you can find appropriate data on to evaluate. So it's oftentimes applied to drugs. You could apply decision analysis to procedures. Let's say if you were looking at final surgery and you were thinking about whether an anterior approach or a posterior approach is going to be more valuable, you could apply a decision analysis to that. Health programs, like we just talked about, you can apply these to screening programs. So you could decide whether you wanted to screen the entire population for cancer, whether you wanted to screen a subset of the population for cancer. You could apply this to vaccines as well, and model what herd immunity would look like as you vaccinate more and more of the population. And you can even evaluate this to reimbursement decisions. So, for example, you could model how provider behavior changes as reimbursement strategies change. So if you wanted to model how provider behavior might change when you reimburse providers based off of fee-for-service versus capitated contracts, that's something that you could even apply to decision analysis. So really the sky is the limit in decision analysis in terms of what potentially you can study using this approach. Where the rubber meets the road is you just need to have high quality enough data in order to populate your decision model. And that's something that we'll talk about in subsequent lectures. I will say right now in quote unquote the real world, much decision analysis is being applied to new drugs. So outside of the United States, many countries that have universal healthcare are interested in using decision analysis in order to understand which new drug technology should enter their market. So when pharmaceutical companies have new drugs that they are bringing to market, if they want to get that drug onto market in the UK, for example, they have to submit a cost-effectiveness analysis alongside information about safety and efficacy in order to show the UK government that it's a good use of their healthcare resources to fund a new drug technology when there may be other drugs on the market that can treat that same condition. The Veterans Administration is also interested in cost-effectiveness analysis and decision analysis. But outside of kind of these two spheres, there isn't a lot of current practical application of decision analysis to inform coverage or reimbursement decisions in the United States. So let's speak a little bit more about the different types of decision analysis one can engage in. So the main types that I want to talk about today are cost-effectiveness analysis, cost-benefit analysis, cost-consequence analysis, and budget impact analysis. So before we go into talking about all of these different types of decision analyses, I'm curious to understand the experiences of the audience. So we have a poll question, and I hope we can still do polls. That essentially is just asking whether you've conducted any type of decision analysis and specifically whether you've conducted cost-effectiveness, cost-benefit, cost-consequence, or budget impact analysis.
And the poll is open. Answers are streaming in. We'll give them a few more moments. Usually levels off around 80%, and we're around 60% right now.
Okay.
Okay, well, things have leveled off pretty well, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll, and you'll see that in answer to the question, what type of decision analysis have you conducted, 34% answered cost-effectiveness, another 34% answered cost-benefit, 8% answered cost-consequence, 20% budget impact, and 47% none. So back to you, Dr. Okay. Mazowski.
All right, thank you. So it sounds like people, those answers add up to more than 100%. So it sounds like some people have experienced more than one type of decision analysis. So that's fantastic. And it looks like we're about evenly split amongst people that do and don't have experience doing these types of modeling activities. So that's not a problem for the purposes of this fiber seminar, because we can help guide you from doing something from scratch to finish, even if you don't have experience. And for the people that have experience, I hope we can help provide some details that will make your lives a little bit easier as you undertake these methods. Okay, so one of the main things, we have a different type of decision analyses, and the common thread amongst them is that they're all comparative. We're all evaluating one option in relation to another. If there was only one option available to us, then we would potentially just go with that. You know what? I'm going to back up, and I'm going to modify that statement a little bit. Even if there is only one intervention available, there is still another option, and that other option could be to do nothing. And so even if you only have one intervention that you're interested in studying, your other option could be to not implement the intervention, and that, of course, is going to have its own downstream effects that you need to model in relation to doing the intervention. And so whenever we engage in these decision analyses, cost consequence, cost benefit, cost effectiveness, budget impact analysis, we're always comparing one intervention in relation to another. And again, other options could be do nothing, it could be follow the standard of care, it could be another active intervention. When we are engaging in cost effectiveness analysis, or CEA, as it's often abbreviated to, we're looking at costs relative to health effects. And those health effects can be anything. They can be life years saved, cases of cancer avoided, number of mothers successfully breastfeeding, number of cases of tuberculosis successfully treated, et cetera, et cetera. As long as you can measure it, it's something that you can evaluate as a health effect. In the cost effectiveness analysis, the result of the cost effectiveness analysis comparing two or more interventions is an incremental cost effectiveness ratio, or an ICER. And what the ICER does is it compares a numerator to a denominator. The numerator is the delta in cost of the two interventions, and the denominator is the delta in health effect amongst the two interventions. And remember, even though we're studying potentially really different interventions, tuberculosis program versus the breastfeeding program, because we're evaluating health effects in the same way, which could be, for example, cost per life year saved, we can evaluate these two different programs using the same health effect and thus get a delta in cost versus a delta in health effect that will allow us to understand which of these two disparate programs is going to provide the most value for the dollars spent. And I should actually mention, when I say that these analyses are comparative, you need to compare one intervention to at least another intervention, but you could compare one intervention to multiple interventions. And so in a cost effectiveness analysis, you could have five different interventions that you're studying. And what you would essentially do is whittle down those five interventions to the two interventions are the ones that are the most valuable, and then you would compare the relative value of each of those two interventions. And we'll talk more about how to actually whittle down from 5, 6, 7 interventions down to two interventions in order to calculate the ICER in future lectures. So cost utility analysis is a particular form of cost effectiveness analysis. So if you think of cost effectiveness analysis as the umbrella term, cost utility analysis is a particular method that falls underneath this umbrella. When we engage in cost utility analysis, we are still looking at cost relative to health effect, but in the case of cost utility analysis, the health effect is now a quality or a quality adjusted life year. So cost utility analysis looks at cost relative to quality adjusted life year. Cost effectiveness analysis looks at cost relative to any health effect. When we think about qualities or quality adjusted life years, the important thing to remember is that the qualities derive from a utility. So here is a quick summary of cost effectiveness analysis versus cost utility analysis before I delve into utilities. So both are comparing two or more interventions. Cost utility analysis falls underneath the umbrella of cost effectiveness analysis. Cost effectiveness analysis can use any health effect in its outcome. Cost utility analysis uses a specific type of health effect called a quality adjusted life year, or a quality, in its outcome. So let's talk more about qualities and utilities. A quality is a function of the number of years of life lived times the utility of that life. So, for example, if somebody lives for 5 years and the utility of their life during those 5 years was 0.8, then their quality would be 5 times 0.8, or 4.0. So a utility is a preference for health. So I want to be clear that utility is not just a measure of health, but it's actually a preference for health. And what the utility does is it combines the health state that a person is in with evaluation of that health state. Utilities generally range from 0 to 1. There are exceptions to this, and we'll talk more about utilities in an upcoming PERC lecture. But for the time being, you should know that utilities conventionally range from 0 to 1, where 0 equals death and 1 is perfect health. So that person that we talked about on the previous slide that had a utility of 0.8 has below perfect health, but is very far from death in terms of valuing his own health state. So let's get a little bit more specific here and use an example so that you can understand properly how utilities are calculated. So here I have a number of different aspects of health-related quality of life that we're going to be measuring when we are trying to calculate our utility. First, we're looking at activities of daily living. We're looking at whether a person can exercise. We're looking at their level of mental clarity, and as well as their emotional well-being. And we have two people here. We have Jane and we have Joe. And now remember, the utilities can range from 0 to 1, where 0 represents the value of being in a death state and 1 represents the value of being in perfect health. So Jane is able to engage in a lot of activities of daily living. She has a score of 0.8, as does Joe. They both have the same value. They're not big exercisers. They can't exercise much. They have values of 0.2, each of them. And they both have the same levels of mental clarity and the same levels of emotional well-being. However, they value the merits of these different aspects of health-related quality of life differently. So Jane values exercise and mental clarity and doesn't value emotional well-being as much. Joe really values activities of daily living. And I don't know if you can see my arrow. Rob, are you guys able to see my arrow here on the screen?
Yes, we can see your cursor.
Okay, perfect. So Joe here really values activities of daily living, doesn't value exercise very much, moderately values mental clarity, doesn't value emotional well-being very much. So you can see that even though Jane and Joe have the exact same values for whether they can engage in these different types of health-related quality of life aspects, they have the same ability to engage in activities of daily living, they have the same ability to exercise, the same mental clarity, the same emotional well-being. Because they value these things differently, they end up having different utilities. So what we do is we multiply the score for activities of daily living times the valuation of that score in order to get to the partial utility that's related to activities of daily living. And we do the same for Joe. And we sum across all the different activities of daily living in order to get a total score. And so Jane's utility for her particular health-related quality of life state is 0.405, whereas Joe's utility for his health-related quality of life state is 0.655. So what I want you to take away from this is that even though Jane and Joe are in the same objectively measured health status, they value that health status differently, and because they value that health status differently, they have different utilities. And that is where a utility is both a measure of health as well as a measure of evaluation of that health, which we call a preference for health. So now that we have our utilities, we need to convert these utilities to qualities or quality-adjusted life years. So Jane's utility, from what we calculated before, is 0.405, and Joe's utility is 0.655. Now, when we translate them to qualities, we look at how long they live times their utility in order to get to their quality. So Jane lives for 10 years. 0.405 times 10 means that she has 4.05 qualities. Joe also lives for 10 years. His qualities is 6.55 because his utility is 0.655. So So again, even though they have the exact same objectively measured health state, they live for the exact same amount of time, their utilities are different because they value those health states differently. So if they live for different amounts of time, Jane lives for 12 years, she would have 4.86 qualities, and Joe lives for 5 years, he would have 3.25 qualities. So now here is where their qualities are both differ because they live for different periods of time, as well as they value differently the health state that they're in for that period of time. So even though Jane started out with a lower utility than Joe did, because Jane lives for longer than Joe, she ultimately has higher qualities than does Joe. So the reason that we are so interested in using utilities and qualities is because they are able to incorporate both morbidity and mortality into a single measure. We're not just looking at the amount of time somebody is alive, we're looking at the utility of their life during their survival. And so being able to incorporate both of those pieces of information into a single health outcome is something that allows us to compare a lot of different types of health intervention strategies. So if you were comparing, if you were, let's say, a health insurer and you were deciding what you could fund, and you could either fund a newborn screening program or you could fund a new type of expensive prostate cancer treatment, those are really different patient populations. Prostate cancer generally affects elderly men. Obviously, a newborn screening program is going to affect people at the very nascent stages of their life. And so how do you even compare the outcomes for these two very different groups of people? You do so using a quality because you can incorporate both the morbidity and mortality into the single measure. And you can do that even if you were evaluating something that wasn't necessarily a medical intervention, but maybe was a healthcare-related intervention or a public health intervention. Even if you wanted to, let's say, look at early childhood education versus funding community health centers, you could still use the utility or a quality in order to understand the effect education had on people's health status throughout their life. So when we are doing a cost-utility analysis, we are still interested in the ICER, the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, as the outcome. In this case, we still have the same ratio where the numerator is the delta in cost between two interventions. The denominator is the delta in health outcomes between two interventions, but in this case, the health outcome is measured as a quality. So how do you actually figure out from this ICER whether one intervention is considered to be the better intervention, the better value for money? Well, what you'll often see in the literature is that if the new intervention costs less than $50,000 additional dollars per quality-adjusted life year gain, that new intervention is considered to be cost-effective relative to the comparator. Now, I have to say that that's a pretty old school of thought, there are some problems associated with using this threshold of $50,000 for quality-adjusted life year. It's not actually empirically based. It was just used in literature in the late 90s, and people just started using it. It was used a few times. It started being cited, used some more. And now it's oftentimes used as a threshold for whether something is cost-effective or not. And I just want to point out that that's not actually anything that's empirically derived. So it's arbitrary, and it's an old school of thought. Okay, let me get back to the ICERs and give you an example of how ICERs can be used in a cost-utility analysis. So again, I'm going to just hammer this into your head. The ICER is the change in cost relative to the change in health outcomes. In the case of cost utility analysis, it's the change in cost relative to the change in qualities across two or more interventions. So let's say we have two programs that we're interested in, and we can only fund one. And the first program is a mobile text messaging app for improving patients' medication adherence for diabetes. And the second intervention is a diabetes care coordinator. Program A is much lower cost than Program B, but Program A also provides fewer qualities than does Program B. So Program A is not as effective as Program B is. So in order to calculate this ICER, we would take $150,000 minus $40,000, and then in the numerator and in the denominator, 35 qualies minus 25 qualies. That gives us a ratio of 110,000 to 10. When we divide 10 into 110,000, we get $11,000 is the ICER. And we would consider this to be cost effective. So we talked in the very beginning about cost effective versus cost saving, and now I want to be very clear about the differences between the two. Oftentimes, people colloquially say something is cost effective when they really mean that it's cost saving. Cost effective can take a number of, can take a couple of different forms. So first, when we talk about cost saving, we're talking about an intervention that costs less than a comparator and it provides more health. That's fantastic. Unfortunately, that doesn't oftentimes happen in healthcare. Usually what happens is that we have an intervention that costs more money and it provides more health. If the new intervention costs more money and it provides proportionally more health, then we consider it cost effective. If a new intervention costs more money and it costs a lot of money and it provides only a small bump in improvement in health outcomes, then it may not be cost effective. But as long as the improvements in health are proportional to the increases in cost associated with the intervention, we'll consider it to be cost effective. There's also another way that a new intervention can be cost effective relative to an existing intervention, and that is that the new intervention costs less money and it provides proportionally less health. And this one can be a little bit politically challenging to implement because you have to, in order to actually implement the intervention that costs less and provides proportionally less health, you have to have an organization that is willing to forego health in order to reduce costs. And in many instances, organizations are not willing to have any sort of decrement in health outcomes, no matter what the cost savings would be. And that is a moral argument rather than a decision analysis conclusion. It's just something to be aware of, that cost effective can also mean that you are getting less health, but you're saving a lot of money in order to get to, in order to compensate for those lower health outcomes. So in healthcare, what we normally see is a new intervention may be cost effective relative to an existing intervention because it costs more and it provides proportionally more health. Generally, what we're trying to do in healthcare is improve health outcomes. We're not just trying to reduce costs. All right, so cost-effective. Program B costs more than Program A, but that's fine because Program B provides proportionally more health benefit than Program A does. And what do I mean by proportional? Proportional means that the ICER, the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, the result of our cost-effectiveness analysis, is less than some sort of willingness to pay threshold. So we talked about $50,000 for quality-adjusted life years. So that means that in the United States, conventionally, people have considered something to be cost-effective, meaning that they're willing to pay up to $50,000 for one additional quality-adjusted life year. And so if you have an intervention that costs up to $50,000 more, but it provides at least one more quality, in the United States, conventionally, we consider that to be cost-effective in the literature. However, that is changing, and part of the reason that's changing is because we spoke about before that that willingness to pay threshold is arbitrary. It's heavily criticized because it's not empirically derived. When we think about what thresholds for willingness to pay should they be $50,000 for quality adjusted life year or $100,000 for quality adjusted life year, that question as to what the right threshold is to compare our ICER to is essentially still outstanding. So the second panel on cost effectiveness in health and medicine last year released an updated textbook about recommendations for how to conduct a cost effectiveness analysis. And in that book, that panel does not endorse any explicit willingness to pay threshold. In fact, they recommend that you compare your ICER or your result to a range of thresholds because decision makers may have different thresholds or people may have different thresholds depending on what you're talking about. You know, people may feel as though avoiding mortality, saving lives, needs a lower threshold than successfully treating an infection, for example. So the severity of the condition that we're talking about may result in decision makers wanting to have different willingness to pay thresholds. We talked about the UK as being a place where they use cost-effectiveness analysis in order to make decisions about what new technologies, including drugs, enter their healthcare market. The NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Effectiveness in the UK, is the organization that that evaluates the cost-effectiveness of new technologies. They themselves don't actually have an explicit threshold for reimbursement. If you look at a lot of the new technologies that have been approved by them, you can see that they oftentimes hover around a willingness to pay threshold of 20,000 to 30,000 pounds per quality adjusted life year. But again, because they don't have an explicit threshold for reimbursement, you will see some new technologies that have higher willingness to pay thresholds that are still reimbursed by NICE or by the UK Health System. Okay, so that was a lot about cost-effectiveness analysis and its subset, cost-utility analysis. And now I want to move on to cost-benefit analysis. In cost-benefit analysis, you have costs and effects that are expressed entirely in dollar terms. And so you're still looking at costs relative to health outcomes, but that health outcome you convert into a cost. And the outcome, the ultimate outcome of a cost-benefit analysis is expressed in terms of a net social benefit. So this is in contrast to the ICER that we spoke about before. In the cost-benefit analysis, the net social benefit is the incremental benefit that's expressed in terms of cost minus the incremental cost. If the net social benefit is positive, then the new intervention is considered to be worthwhile. So when you are trying to convert a health effect to a cost, you need to assign a dollar value to life. You need to say X number of life years or X number of qualities corresponds to Y dollars. And that is challenging, as you might imagine. And there's a couple of different ways that one can do this. One way to assign a dollar value to a health outcome or a dollar value to life is to use a willingness to pay approach, where you look at revealed willingness to pay or illicit willingness to pay. So if you are looking at revealed willingness to pay, you might look at how much people are willing to pay for a certain intervention. So one example of this is LASIK surgery. LASIK eye surgery is not covered by insurance. It's an entirely private market interaction. And so we can understand how much people value the improvement in their eyesight due to LASIK based on how much they're willing to pay for it. If you can't actually observe willingness to pay, if you can't look at revealed willingness to pay because it's just not practical to do so, you can elicit willingness to pay. So you can ask people a series of hypothetical questions and ask them how much they would be willing to pay for certain health status or improvements or decrements in health-related quality of life. Now, there's a lot of challenges associated with evaluating willingness to pay in this manner. We know from a canon of behavioral economics literature that the way in which you frame a question matters. People may also have loss aversion, also from behavioral economics, that people would rather avoid a loss than seek an equivalent gain. And so that's related to these framing effects in terms of how you present a hypothetical example to a patient in terms or a person in terms of eliciting willingness to pay. There also may be age-related effects. Somebody who is retired or on a fixed income may not be able to pay as much as somebody who isn't, and so the revealed willingness to pay may look very different. Again, if people have varying levels of disposable income, if we're talking about someone that makes $30,000 a year versus $150,000 a year, their revealed willingness to pay may look extremely different, even if they value the intervention the same, because they may not have the ability to actually spend the money on that intervention. So there is also another approach to assigning a dollar value to life, and that's the human capital approach. And that is an approach where you use someone's earnings in order to value their life. And so this rests on, you know, some somewhat problematic assumptions that the value of an individual is entirely measured by their formal employment. And, of course, this has problems because children are employed and retired people are employed, and yet we don't consider them to be entirely unvaluable to society. So how do you actually value someone if they aren't formally employed? There's also issues of inequalities in society that can trickle into these types of evaluations. We know that women get paid less than men for the same work, even though they have the same skill sets and the same education level. We know that people of African-American background get paid less than white people do. So these are inequalities that we don't want to perpetuate throughout our models. So the actual recommendation, and I have to thank Professor Louise Russell for pointing me towards this information. Thank you, Dr. Russell, if you're on the call. The recommended approach is to actually use willingness to pay and to not use the human capital approach when you are assigning a dollar value to life in cost-benefit analysis. Cost-benefit analysis is not used very often in healthcare and medicine, and the reasons are probably obvious to you after we just discussed the previous slide, and that is that it's very challenging to properly assign a dollar value to life. There are challenges with the, even though the willingness to pay approach is the recommended approach, there are still a lot of challenges to operationalizing that properly. And there's problems with evaluating the quality of life as well. It's hard enough to assign a dollar value to a life year saved. It's very hard to assign a dollar value to a utility of 0.8 versus a utility of 0.6 for that particular year of life. The last thing I want to discuss is cost-consequence analysis. Cost-consequence analysis compares the cost and the consequences in terms of health outcomes of multiple interventions. And unlike the ICERs that we get from the cost-effectiveness and the cost-utility analysis, in a cost-consequence analysis, what we do is we list out each cost and each consequence separately in our results. So this is an example of a cost-consequence tabulation, and this comes from Josephine Malkoff and her colleagues publishing in Pharmacoeconomics in 1998. And we're looking at two drugs, and you can see that they are breaking out the pros and the cons of each aspect of using these two drugs in very specific ways. So they have their direct medical care cost, the cost of the drug, the cost of the physician visit. Then they also have the direct non-medical cost, how much it costs to get to the doctor's office, how much it costs to get a caregiver when using each one of these drugs, how much it costs now in indirect a manner to miss work for the patient, for the caregiver. And then they also have symptom impact in terms of health effects, how much was the patient disabled, distressed, what was their quality of life impact. So you get really a very detailed picture of the impact of using each one of the interventions. So the advantages is that it draws your attention to the specific aspects of the cost or the health outcomes that are most impacted. But the disadvantage is that because it doesn't tell you the relative importance of each one of these items, it's really hard for different people to review the exact same cost-consequence analysis and always come away with the same recommendation about which intervention to fund. So we talked previously about Jane and Joe and how they had the exact same objectively measured health status, but they valued aspects of those health status differently, and thus they ended up with different utilities. The same kind of thing can happen here in a cost-consequence analysis. Maybe I, as a decision maker, am really interested in the cost of hospital stays, and another decision maker is really interested in the amount of time missed from work, because that is maybe a self-insuring corporation. And so the self-insuring corporation and I as a decision maker may end up with entirely different conclusions about which interventions to fund because they have a differential impact on each of those outcomes that we value differently. Okay, I'm sorry. I said cost consequence was the last, but really I meant budget impact analysis. All right, so budget impact analysis in the last few minutes. I'll try to wrap up quickly. Budget impact analysis is something that we actually do quite a bit in the VA, and that's where we estimate the financial consequences of adopting a new intervention. And generally, this is done in addition to a cost-effectiveness analysis. So the cost-effectiveness analysis tells us, does the intervention provide good value? Which is fantastic. We need to know that. But the budget impact analysis answers the follow-up question, which is, now that we know the intervention provides good value, can we afford it? And that is a difference, but also important questions for any type of decision. So let's say we have two drugs, and drug A has an ICER of $28,000 per quality compared with drug B. And we're going to consider that to be cost-effective. Drug B costs $70,000. That means in order to get a one quality gain, as we shift from drug B to drug A, we need to spend $98,000. Drug A is going to cost us $98,000 for that one additional quality that we get. There are 10,000 people that are eligible in our healthcare system for drug A, and that means that we will have to expend $980 million in order to treat people with drug A. So even though drug A is cost-effective relative to drug B, we as a healthcare system may not be able to spend almost $1 billion in 1 year on treating these people. So, and this actually is an example that has recent relevance. So if we think about the new hepatitis C medications that cost $95,000, $100,000, $80,000, we know that they're highly cost-effective. That work has been published. I've done some of it, as have multiple other people. But the budget impact question becomes really substantial, because in order to treat everybody that has hepatitis C, especially in the VA, we're looking at outlays of billions of dollars. And that is something that we as a healthcare system cannot afford in 1 year because of the opportunity cost. We wouldn't be able to treat anybody else. So when we go through budget impact analyses, they can be really important. They tell us both what the true unit cost of the intervention, and combine that information but with the number of people affected by the intervention. And that, in total, gives an understanding of the aggregate budget required to fund the intervention. So importantly, the cost-effectiveness analysis is going to tell you whether something is valuable on a unit basis. The budget impact analysis says, okay, now let's look at what's happening on a unit basis times the number of units that we need in order to understand really the healthcare system impact. So in the cost-effectiveness analysis versus the budget impact analysis, DEA, does this intervention provide high value? BIA is, can we afford it? The outcome in a CEA is cost relative to health outcomes. The budget impact analysis is only looking at cost. We have already decided that the health outcomes we get relative to the cost is valuable. Now we just want to look and see how much the financial impact of the intervention will be. In the cost effectiveness analysis, we don't explicitly consider the size of the population, because we're looking at more of a unit-based measure of value. The budget impact analysis definitely looks at the size of the population. So we will have a budget impact analysis lecture that's coming up. I encourage all of you guys to attend that if you're interested in finding out more. Okay, so now that we've gone over the different types of decision analyses, a quick poll as to which type you are most interested in conducting.
Risha, the poll is up, but let me just say that we can go a little bit late if it's okay with you, because there are a number of questions that Wei has queued up. And if you do decide that we can go late, I would just say to the audience, please do fill out the feedback form if you have to leave right at the top of the hour.
The poll I'm question, happy to stay.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I'm happy to stay as long as needed.
Wonderful. The poll question, what type of decision analysis are you most interested in conducting? And again, this is choose as many answers that are appropriate, so you'll get more than 100% again. We've had it's leveled off, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and read you the results. 70% say that they're interested in cost effectiveness, 34% say cost benefit, 23% say cost consequence, and 45% budget impact. I'm not sure how much those numbers mean, but back to you.
Okay, great, thank you. All right, in the interest of time, I'm gonna try to go quickly through the remaining slides. So in terms of the approaches, how do you actually conduct a decision analysis? Whether it's a budget impact analysis, cost effectiveness analysis, cost utility, cost consequence, there are two main categories with which you can operationalize it. One is that you actually make a model yourself, and the other is where you do a measurement alongside a clinical trial, where you piggyback your data collection onto existing clinical trial efforts. So when we are doing a cost-effectiveness analysis, you can do that either by measuring alongside a clinical trial or modeling. Cost-benefit analysis, you can measure alongside a clinical trial or you can model. And in a budget impact analysis, that generally really just requires modeling, because, again, you're looking at the size of the population, and the clinical trial is, of course, not going to have the entire population in the clinical trial. So when we measure alongside a clinical trial, we piggyback onto an existing clinical trial. What you're essentially doing is just collecting extra information from the patients that are enrolled in the trial. So you would collect information about their utilization, and then behind the scenes, you would assign cost to that utilization. You would directly elicit utility data from them, and then you would already have efficacy information and adverse events being collected by the principal investigator of the clinical trial, so you would just include that information as well in your analysis. You engage in a modeling exercise where your entire study is predicated upon a model that you build yourself in a software program. And you do that when there is no real-world randomized control trial that you could piggyback on. And the model is a mathematical framework that helps you explicitly understand the relationship between inputs and outputs. And so you use software in order to build your model, and that gives you the framework, the model structure. And then you go to the literature and you do extensive literature searches in order to get inputs from your model. And then you run your model in the software using these literature-derived inputs in order to obtain your outputs or your results. And when you're doing a model, you decide on the parameters of the analysis. So you decide how long of a time frame you're going to model people for, which population you're interested in, which interventions you're interested in. So you have a lot more flexibility than if you would piggyback onto an existing clinical trial. In terms of modeling versus measurement, of course, if you are modeling, you can study any treatment. When you're measuring alongside the clinical trial, you can only include the treatments that are in the randomized control trial, one of which might be a placebo. But even when you are modeling, while you are able to study any treatment of interest, you still need to get the information from the literature about the efficacy and adverse events of the treatment from randomized control. The advantage of the measurement approach is that you can design your data collection strategy so that you can get whatever information you're specifically interested in. You have the individual patient-level data, so you can do interesting subgroup analyses, and you may be able to get information about utilities that are more specific to the treatment and the health condition that's being studied. The advantage of modeling is you don't need to wait for a trial to be funded to do your analysis, and that's a huge advantage because trials are very expensive and far in between. The disadvantage to measurement alongside a clinical trial is that you have a short time frame. Most clinical trials last for months, maybe a couple of years. You are probably going to want to model people out for multiple years, so you're still going to have to project data beyond the time horizon of the data being collected in the clinical trial, and that is its own bag of worms. And even though you can design case report forms to collect a lot of data, you won't really be able to get every single input you want for your decision model. You'll still have to go, your decision analysis, I should say. You're still going to have to go to literature. And then when you're measuring alongside a clinical trial, if you're getting utilities from the patient rather than from the community, that can be a disadvantage, and we'll talk more about that in the utility lecture. The disadvantage of modeling is that when you are going to the literature in order to get inputs for your decision model, you need to make sure that the studies that you're using to pluck those inputs are similar enough to the population you're trying to study in your decision analysis, and sometimes that can be challenging. Okay, so I'm going to probably skip through these very quickly because we are nearing the top of the hour. In fact, I think I'll just let you guys look at these yourself. So in summary, major types of decision analysis: budget impact, cost-benefit, cost-consequence, cost-effectiveness. Cost-effectiveness has a subset, which is cost-utility analysis. The cost-utility analysis uses qualities for health outcomes. When you operationalize your decision analysis, you can either piggyback onto an existing clinical trial, or you can engage in a from-scratch model yourself. And I hope by now you understand that cost-effective does not necessarily mean cost saving. Cost effective means that we are getting a delta in cost that is proportional to the delta in health effects. So if you are interested in learning more about cost effectiveness analysis, decision analysis, there's a number of citations here. I'd recommend actually reading all of them. They're fantastic, and they vary in terms of their practical application versus their theory. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to stick around, but my email address is also up on the screen for folks that would like to contact me that way.
Okay. Do we have time to answer questions?
Sure, we can go over about 15 minutes.
Okay. Now, let me pick up a few questions because I tried to answer some of them. Now, the first question, I just go from the earlier. The question is from Kenneth Cox. The question is, when calculating a ICER, is the result always interpreted as the absolute value of the calculation? For example, cost for program B is less than cost of program A, while health effectiveness exceeds that of program B. So that's it.
Wait, I couldn't understand you. Can you repeat what the question is?
When question you're is, when ICER, is the result always interpreted as the absolute value of the calculation? I think if the question means, do they have a negative or positive, or we just put a, so if it's A and B, and the one is less than the other.
Yeah, you can have a negative. Yeah, I got this way. Thanks. Well, you can have a negative ICER. So you can have, when the intervention costs less money, and then it can have a negative value. If the intervention costs less money and it provides, and it reduces health, and you have a negative in the numerator, a negative in the denominator, those cancel out. And so what you really want to do in a cost effectiveness analysis is you plot your results on a cost effectiveness graph. And so then you'll understand whether the intervention costs more money, provides less benefit, costs more money, provides more benefit, et cetera, et cetera. And you'll see that in, I think, the next lecture that I do. But no, it's not the absolute value. If there are negative numbers in the numerator or denominator, they stay in the ICER.
Okay. Then another question, I think there are two questions. They asked where to find your slides. I think that can be provided later. The second question, how is cost avoidance incorporated or utilized or calculated? From Laurel Trailer.
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's say we were interested in two interventions, and intervention A costs a lot more money, but it avoids hospital stays relative to intervention B. What we would do is, when we look at the patients that got intervention A versus intervention B, we would cost out all of their utilization. We cost out their drugs, their inpatient stays, their outpatient stays, et cetera, et cetera. So if intervention A has a high drug cost but offsets that by reducing hospital utilization, that would be something that we would see in lower hospital costs for the patients getting intervention A relative to intervention B. And so those cost offsets would be incorporated into the inputs for the decision model.
Okay. And another question is asked, can you model something without a clinical trial?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you still want your input to come from a clinical trial as much as possible. And the reason is because, I should say randomized control trial. So the reason is, if you randomize patients to one intervention versus another, then you don't have issues of selection bias at play. And so if you are taking your inputs from observational studies, you would have to make sure that you were doing proper statistical adjustments for selection bias or other confounders to make sure that the biases present in the measurement of effectiveness of the intervention weren't being propagated throughout your decision model. So when you conduct your own model, to the extent possible, try to get inputs from randomized controlled trials. It is, some of the inputs, it's going to be challenging to do that.
Okay. Then there's another question from Nina Smith. In trying to understand the difference between the CUA, cost utility analysis, and the CEA, which is cost effectiveness analysis, what is the purpose of CUA?
So the CUA, the cost utility analysis, is just a subset of the cost effectiveness analysis. So the cost utility analysis is looking at health outcomes specifically in terms of qualities or quality adjusted life years. in a cost-effectiveness analysis, you're interested in health outcomes. Those health outcomes could be qualities, they could be life years saved, they could be cases of infection avoided. They can really be any health outcome. And so they're essentially operationalized the same way. It's really more of defining what cost-effectiveness is versus cost-utility analysis is. If you see someone's doing a cost-utility analysis, you know right off the bat their health outcome that they used was a quality.
Okay. Now, there's another question I think is about its continue of this. Is the question is there a consideration of quality being measured over only a snapshot in time versus over someone's lifespan?
So this is a question about the parameters of your analysis. So you, as the investigator, get to decide how long your decision analysis should run for. It could run for the lifetime of the patient, and that would be ideal, is that you model a patient from the time they get the intervention until they die. But that may not be feasible for you to do. You may think that really the differences between intervention A and intervention B are going to are really going to occur in the first 5 years after the intervention. So maybe you model patients for 10 years just to be sure. In a budget impact analysis, the time horizons are much shorter than when you're doing a cost-effectiveness analysis. Cost-effectiveness analysis, if you can model patients from the time of intervention to death, that's great. In a budget impact analysis, usually the time horizon is 3 to 5 years because budget impact analyses are used for decision makers to allocate resources and budgets, and generally they're not thinking beyond that time frame.
Okay, and another question is also related. If the evaluations are measured by a survey, can they change over time? That's more empirical.
If an evaluation is measured by a survey, can it change over time?
Yeah.
There are variables. Some variables are time varying and some are time invariant. Race and gender are examples of time invariant variables. Health status, health-related quality of life could vary over time, certainly.
Okay. And I think the last question is it's about doing nothing when the intervention compared with the doing nothing. And the question is that doing nothing would yield some consequences that cost us. But applying new interventions would have both costs and savings. So are these comparable?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly compare them. The important thing to realize about a do-nothing approach is that it has its own cost consequences. So let's say you have a patient that has an infection and you want to do nothing. Well, that infection could spread, the patient could get septic, it could run up really high ICU and hospital bills. And so even though there was no capital investment associated with doing nothing, there were downstream costs associated with doing nothing that that are important and that need to be considered when conducting a decision analysis of an active intervention relative to a do-nothing approach.
Okay, I think that's about all the questions. So maybe we can close here. If people have more questions, you can send to Risha, and her email is available, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good. Well,
wonderful.
Thank you all for your time. Oh, I'm done. Thank you all.